I feel good. Glad we could bring in the morning with you guys here on the American Journal. Rex, we got some new news coming out, breaking, right?
We have conflicting information. Apparently, it's been confirmed by Axios. That's Mario Newfall reporting it's been confirmed by Axios that they did indeed shoot down the F-15. Now, we've got a statement from U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, from 17 hours ago, where they say, claim Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard says it downed an enemy fighter jet. It says, fact, all U.S. fighter aircraft are accounted for. What's going on here on Axios, then?
It says the IRGC has made some false claim at least half a dozen times. Okay. You know, again, this is like
fog of war.
This is fog of war. This is propaganda going back and forth. And they want to confuse you on both sides so that you can't tell what's the truth. That's why we have independent news. Didn't you have an article or Mario's reporting on something?
Mario's reporting on it. I don't want to get too much into the conflicting information. I just want to let people know right now there's an active dispute between the two countries. America says we haven't lost any planes. Iran says we've lost a plane. Now it's being confirmed by Axios, which really is a U.S. government mouthpiece, that this has happened. I really don't think this story would have come out if there wasn't some substance to it. Just want to let you know you're going to want to tune into Alex Jones' show and the War Room. I'm sure more will come out. But go ahead. Let's get into the deep dive. Let's talk about Ukraine.
Yes, deep dive. This is my favorite part. This is something that's near and dear to my heart. Again, we do the deep dives to give you guys information, give you guys context beyond the headlines. What we're going to be talking about today is the Ukraine war and the things that are not so mainstream, because there's a lot of confusion on why the United States and Russia and Ukraine have gotten into this situation. And sure, you have to go very far back to understand how we actually got to today.
And just really quick, we're told the Star Wars story of poor, innocent little Ukraine. Russia comes in for absolutely no reason. And you're like, oh, well, NATO expansion, all these reasons. Go ahead and get into
it. Okay, well, let me just preface this before I get started. Okay, I spend a lot of time doing this research. I do it in an impartial way. When I go in and I look at facts, and I don't look at skewing it one way or another or giving you a spin. It is up to you, the viewer, the listener at home, to make your own decision and judgment based off of the information that I'm going to give you, okay? So let's talk about the Russia-Ukraine war. The war that nobody explained to you. So if you've been following the Russia-Ukraine war, you probably think it started in 2022, but that's not actually the real story. This conflict has gone all the way back into the 1990s, right? And the US, the UK, the NATO have been involved from the very beginning of this process. And so the NATO governments have sent hundreds of billion dollars to Ukraine.
Yes.
And so US officials are actually acknowledging this whole thing about a proxy war. So why does most of the coverage skipped the first 30 years, and we're starting to see this pressure build up. And we can pull up this graphic of the Soviet Union, because we need to look at these photos and understand what's happening here. So the Soviet Union was something that happened throughout the 80s and ended in the 90s, okay? And you can see all of the countries in that graphic.
It started after the revolution.
It started after
World War II, we're talking about.
Yes, I meant to say it carried all the way through.
It 1991, ended. It dissolved.
It dissolved in 1991, and they had this whole thing, communism, socialism, whatever you want to say. It didn't work out, okay?
Uh-oh.
It didn't work out, and that's part of the reason why you had the whole Cold War. So in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. Russia went from a superpower, and it broke overnight. So this Boris Yeltsin took over, governed from 1991 to 1999, and then his vision was simple. He wanted to just partner with the West and end the hostility and just join the global economy. But that's not actually what happened. So in 1992, Russia basically adopted this radical economic policy that we came up with known as shock therapy. And the idea from the United States was this.
Immediate capitalism.
Well, it was immediate capitalism and open the markets. The idea was to take the state run and make everything privatized as quickly as possible, similar to how we have here in the government,
right?
Is only an entity and it doesn't control everything. And so they would open up the markets, they would sell off the government industries, and they would remove price controls all at once. And then if if it wasn't for some rogue experiment, and if it was endorsed by the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, and Clinton administration, they all supported this.
Sure, and we sent economic hitmen over to their country to divide it up and chop it up and run it. We're like, oh, well, you know, we got – oh, you got the company milk, the country's milk, the USSR milk. It's our milk now. But it became too expensive for those companies to produce those things. You got mass shortages. Talk about the shock therapy.
So let's watch this video that explains shock therapy. Pay attention here. This video is important to the context of everything. Go ahead and roll the clip.
Publix. Enter Boris Yeltsin, the first president of the Russian Federation. Yeltsin inherited a country in turmoil, shrinking economy, rising nationalism, and widespread uncertainty. To address these challenges, he turned to Western economists and institutions like the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, who advocated for shock therapy. Shock therapy was rooted in the belief that transitioning to capitalism should be as rapid and sweeping as possible. The idea was that short-term pain would lead to long-term gain. His architects, like Jeffrey Sachs and Anders Esplund, argue that gradual reforms risked a return to socialism. Instead, they pushed for a clean break, dismantling the planned economy in one fell swoop. The first step was lifting price controls, which had kept goods affordable during the Soviet era. Overnight, prices skyrocketed. In January 1992 alone, basic necessities became unaffordable for many. A loaf of bread that once cost a few kopecks suddenly cost several rubles. Hyperinflation reached 1,354% that year, wiping out savings and plunging millions into poverty. For ordinary Russians, this was a nightmare. Imagine an elderly pensioner who had saved her entire life under the Soviet system, only to find that her money was now worthless. People began selling heirlooms, furniture, and even clothes in makeshift street markets just to survive. This period became a symbol of desperation, grandmothers hawking antique samovars and men bartering tools for food. Unemployment, a concept virtually unknown in the USSR, surged as industries shut down or downsized. State-owned factories, once the backbone of Soviet life, could no longer compete in the global market. Entire towns built around a single factory, known as monotowns, were devastated, leaving residents without jobs or prospects. Privatization was another cornerstone of shock therapy, and it was here that the seeds of Russia's oligarchy were sown. State assets, from oil fields to aluminum plants, were sold off at bargain prices. Ordinary Russians were given vouchers to buy shares in these enterprises, but most sold them for cash to survive. The beneficiaries, a small group of well-connected insiders who amassed vast fortunes almost overnight. Take the example of Roman Abramovich, who acquired the Sibneft Oil Company for a fraction of its value, or Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who became one of the richest men in Russia by acquiring Yukosoil. These oligarchs wielded immense power, not just economically, but politically, shaping Russia's future in ways that still resonate today.
Okay, Rex and I lit up at the same time. Rex, you want to talk about that quote that you just wrote down?
Well, where have we heard short-term pain, long-term gain before? We're hearing it right now about this war, about this conflict. You see, propaganda never changes. Just the application of the propaganda is different.
Well, that is the whole reason why we do these deep dives, because it uncovers history, and humans have a repeatable pattern in which we've done these things before, we've lived through. So anything you're hearing now where we talk about short-term pain for long-term gain, we've seen it not play out before. So how do we think that it's going to play out positively today?
Right. And I mean, past behavior is the best indicator of present and future behavior. And what do these governments do? Whenever we look at history, they're always just finding ways to screw the people. Look, it's like, oh, we're going to make it equitable. We're going to give everybody shares in these companies that we're going to sell off. But we know everyone's starving. We know everyone needs to sell the shares for bread, for oil, for food. So and the oligarchs are going to get it. It's just you understand this when you set the system up. And I think a lot of the time, like with this war, they're like, we didn't know the strait would be closed. What? And they're like, well, we know it's going to be closed. It's our calculation. We got to have regime change. So they just tell us the truth, please.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tim.
Well, let's just look at what happened to Russia's GDP after this. And you're going to be shocked. Russia's GDP fell approximately 50% in less than a decade.
Wow.
50%. Let's go ahead and pull up this graphic so that you can see it. It is insane. When we look at these situations, and you just see, okay, so we'll read this real quick. Russia's GDP fell by 50% between 1992 and 1998, and the industrial production declined by 56% in the same time period.
Well, that's called winning. Like, that's the same winning we're dealing with right now. And that's also probably how it was sold as well.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, well, but wait, there's more. We got to look at what also happened, because now you saw the inflation go up 1,300%. You also see the rate at which men are dying starts to go up in incrementally. And so life expectancy is starting to get crater and crime starts to surge and drug abuse starts to explode. Right. And then ordinary Russians are drowning. And this one tiny group at the top, the oligarch, is just sitting there salivating.
It's the new ruling class.
Yes. So can we pull up that life expectancy chart? And you're just going to see how much the life expectancy.
Ooh.
So you can see in 1985, they were doing okay. And then the U.S. just comes in 1990 and they're like, all right.
Dude, they had a life expectancy of 57 yeah. years at one point. You look at France, you look at the West there, and you look at that kind of gradual uptick as healthcare gets better, as technology gets better, as lives improve and as things get easier. And you look at them, they're in the hurt locker.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And look at France. France is chilling. France is like, hey, we don't really care. And they're also involved in these decisions, right? So I want to pull up that quote also of Boris quote.
Borachovsky.
Yeah. So he's just talking about, he's basically bragging here that a handful of bankers controlled about half of Russia's economy and most of its media. You can go ahead and read this.
Sure. Borachovsky said the exclusive club of tycoons included Smolensky and Potanin. I don't know how you say it.
Skip their names.
Along with banker, I'm going to try to do it, and media mogul Vladimir A. Guchinsky, now 46, oil magnate and banker Mikhail B. Kordachovsky, 35, and bankers Mikhail M. Fredman, 34, and Pyotr O'Avin, 43, who together had the Alpha Group of financial firms. Among them, Borachovsky claimed, they controlled half of Russia's economy.
It's insane. 50%.
Making all the decisions.
Seven people controlling 50%. What do you think that does? Do you think that they have the right morals to do the right thing by the Russian people?
No, they just want things to be good for them. They're going to destroy the country.
Right. So then there's also, we got to look at this William Burns cable, because the U.S. ambassador warned Washington that if Russians felt humiliating and that they believed that the West was exploiting their weakness after the Soviet Union departed, right? So this shock therapy didn't just collapse the economy, it poisoned the entire relationship, Rex.
Right.
And so the Russians came out of the 1990s believing that the West was going to do something to help them, but they ended up almost destroying them almost on purpose, it seems like.
Sure. Well, I mean, the goal is like the smash and grab, the destabilization. We see a lot of that here with people getting rich and making all these insider trading, all these deals. What happens? You have a response. And what's that response called? Vladimir Putin. We're going to get into that a little bit later in the deep dive. But ultimately, what we're seeing here in America is a reflection of the Soviet Union, because bad leadership is going to lead to that strong man.
Yes.
And people are going to want that. That's what Fuentes always talks about, is you have one guy, maybe he doesn't care too much about human rights, but he's going to change things for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that starts to become a very dangerous calculation
as
time goes on.
Yep. Right? 100%. Now, let's go ahead and pull up number 6 that talks about William Burns in this cable is saying that the West is taking advantage. So let's go ahead and read this, Rex, if you could read that.
Sure. Winter in Russia is not a time for optimists, and in some respects, the popular mood here mirrors the descending gloom. Born of a mood of national regret over the loss of superpower status and an equally acute sense that the West is taking advantage of Russia's weakness, assertive policies abroad have become one of the few themes that unite Russians. Yeltsin wished to reaffirm Russia's great power status and its interest in neighboring post-Soviet republics.
Yeah, so he is important here. And he's one of these people who's in the government, who's trying to almost whistleblow in some certain capacity, but no one cares.
No one cares.
So and we're seeing these things play out all over and over again. And then the biggest thing here is NATO. We made some promises during the 90s that we have not kept. So while Russia was falling apart, NATO was expanding east. And for context, NATO's military alliance, it's pretty much if you're in NATO – an attack on you is an attack on everyone
Article
else.
5.
Everyone knows this. So NATO is moving closer to Russia's borders, but it's not just politics. It's a direct military threat. And just remember, we promised Russia when we were taking the Soviet Union that we wouldn't move one inch east.
And that's so key. I want to come in here and talk about this.
Go ahead.
Keep this graphic up here on the screen for a second. After 1991, NATO added 12 countries. After 1991, the USSR, now Russia, dissolved the Warsaw Pact, which made all those post-Soviet republics now post-Soviet republics. Russia even tried to join NATO twice.
Yeah.
We didn't want that to happen. Here's a little trivia question for you, Tim. on that map there, where, which country on that map, it's actually not on that map, which country have they had the second most NATO exercises? 36.
36? Well, what, are you thinking Ukraine?
Ukraine. That's right. So they use Ukraine as this military staging ground. They use this Ukraine situation as something they've given pseudo security guarantees to. And ultimately, they've desperately wanted NATO to, or Ukraine to join NATO because that's the completion of the security armada against Russia in their mind.
Yeah.
And they just, they can't let go of that Cold War threat.
Well, yeah. And like I said, the U.S. secretary said this, right?
Sure.
James Baker, he told Gorbachev, who was the one who was making the negotiations, he said we wouldn't move east. And as you pointed sure. out, we went another country and another country. And then you're starting to see in 1999, we took Poland, Hungary, the Czech, the Czech Republic. And now Russia's just seeing all these things play out. And then we have something that happens in 1999 that also contributes to changing the narrative around NATO's position, because NATO was created as a defensive pack, not right. an offensive pack.
Not an offensive
pack.
Alliance, a defensive
pack. Okay, so let's go ahead and pull up and play number 8 here that's going to talk about the bombing of Yugoslavia, and it changes the rhetoric and the tone for the rest of the world going forward from this bombing.
Had broken theirs. Russia may have taken the expansion of NATO more lightly if it weren't for another major event in 1999, the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia.
The first bombing of its kind in NATO history. On March 24, 1999, Western nations carried out their threat against Serbia and began the biggest military conflict on Serbian soil since World War II.
This was the first time NATO used military force without the approval of the UN Security Council, and thus international legal approval. This showed that NATO would operate not only as a defensive alliance, but an offensive alliance that had no problem bombing sovereign states it disapproved of. Russia observed all of this and never forgot it. Even the famous Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn decried the action, saying, "NATO has proclaimed to the whole world, might is right. Those who are strong are always right." He added that it was the destruction of a beautiful country in full view of humanity, while civilized governments applaud this. Not only Russia, but many countries across the world opposed these actions by NATO. It was a serious departure from what NATO claimed to stand for, and people would not quickly forget this.
All right, we got to look at timeline here. I'm going to jump in a little bit. What's going on in 1999? Oh, Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal. So Bill Clinton decides to bomb Yugoslavia, to bomb Kosovo, I believe, for 79 days. Mm-hmm. That's an example of now modern foreign policy. That's distracting from the Epstein files.
Distracting 1.0. From that. So it's great analysis there.
Sure.
You kind of create some noise over here. Don't look at what I did over here.
Right.
Create some noise over there. Get everybody to – but again, it's like – people don't look at the long-term chain reaction that happens.
Sure.
Right? And this graphic is showing you, the NATO alliance, it just keeps going up, and you just see country after country after country. This is a great graphic here. And then look at that. So again, do you see where we're moving to? I mean, you just see all the countries ganging up, and then it leaves room for a new president to come in, which we know as Vladimir Putin in 2000, because the Russian population is unhappy.
They're done with it.
They're done with it. Their entire economy decimated 50% over an 8-year period. And then now you have Vladimir Putin who comes in and he starts cracking down on the oligarchs. Okay. He was part of the KGB, but you can tell, and this isn't like me being, oh, I love Putin. I mean, Putin has murdered people, but again, he is coming in here with a reason to save his people, and he cracks down on the oligarchs, he reasserted state control, and he basically stabilized the economy. And so then you start seeing after 2000s, the living standards go up, crime starts to drop, and this is why Putin has become popular, or why he even became popular, because he gave Russian stability after the decade of chaos.
Sure, I mean, that's the key thing to always point out. Like you're talking about, like, of course, all these world leaders are killers. But Trump had the key line in that 60 Minutes interview you always call back to. And the guy's talking to him. He goes, "You know, Putin's a killer, sir. Putin's a killer. You really want to work with Putin? He's a murderer." And he goes, Trump goes, "You think we're so innocent?" And that's the nature of global politics.
Yeah. Excellent point. And here's the thing. Even after all of that that happened in the 90s, the relations with the U.S. didn't just improve. And after 9/11, Russia was actually one of the first countries to offer the U.S. support.
Right.
And they wanted to come in and they wanted to share intelligence. They offered cooperation with the Bush administration. And then NATO kept expanding anyways after the point at which these situations happen. Okay?
Sure.
And then it goes right up to Russia's border. And then 2007, Putin's like, I've had enough, man. And so he goes in and he stands in front of the Munich Security Conference and he publicly calls out NATO of its expansion and serious provocation that's happening. And he says, against whom is this expansion intended for? Let's go ahead and roll up clip number 9 here. And it's going to show you Putin and what he says during this conference.
All of this. When 9/11 happened, Russia still declared full support to the U.S. in fighting terrorism. America didn't seem to care about this gesture of goodwill. In 2004, NATO underwent another round of eastward expansion, this time taking in the Baltic states, Romania, and several other Eastern European countries. In 2005, President Putin complained to American diplomats, "You Americans need to listen more. You can't have everything your way anymore. We can have effective relations, but not just on your terms." In February 2007, he delivered a dramatic speech in Munich where he protested the continuous expansion of NATO.
"It turns out that NATO has put its frontline forces on our borders, and we continue to strictly fulfill the treaty obligations and do not react to these actions at all. I think it is obvious that NATO expansion does not have any relation with the modernization of the alliance itself or with ensuring security in Europe. On the contrary, it represents a serious provocation that reduces the level of mutual trust, and we have the right to ask, against whom is this expansion intended?"
What do you think about that, Rex?
I think it's a fair question. I mean, you say you need this security alliance, this defense, this offensive alliance that's going to bomb these countries. Who are you protecting the people in your alliance against? You're trying to protect them against us. And I mean, he put over the overtures. He tried to join NATO twice.
He did try to join NATO twice.
So we look at it and we're like, well, we want things to get better in the world. We have hope for change. And we see world leaders say, hey, you know what? Maybe we're motivated in our own self-interest. Why are you being aggressive towards us? We're not trying to declare war on you. And then you see these military actions happen decades later. You see the Russian invasion into Ukraine. And then people talk about it like it all happens in a vacuum.
This is why we talk about the history.
Right.
This is why we give you guys context. Because these things are not just readily available that they're just reporting on them on a regular basis. No, it's headline after headline. New bombing happens here. Explosion here. Donetsk is under fire. And it's like, okay, well, can we start asking more macro level questions and understand, okay, why are we in this in the first situation?
Sure.
I mean, the Biden administration, I'm going to cover in the deep dive.
We got a lot more.
What was the whole reason why this also played out? But we're going to be coming up on a break here, but yes. Again, you guys don't want to go anywhere. We are only halfway through the deep dive, and there are a lot more details for you guys to know about. We will be back after the break. This is Rex Jones and Tim Tompkins on the American Journal. See you after the break. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know the power of turmeric, but have you felt it? Have you tried the ultimate turmeric gummies, the delicious way to harness the ancient power of golden turmeric, supercharged with ginger root and black pepper for maximum impact? Each gummy delivers 125 milligrams of premium turmeric extract packed with curcumin, the clinically studied compound shown to support healthy inflammation response, ease everyday aches, and promote joint comfort so you can move through life with ease. We added real ginger root, trusted for centuries to calm digestion and soothe the stomach, plus a precise dose of black pepper extract with pepperine, proven to boost curcumin absorption by up to 2,000%. That means more of the good stuff actually gets where your body needs it. No capsules, no bitter aftertaste, just one tasty tropical-flavored gummy a day, or two if you're feeling extra, to help you feel lighter, looser, and more energized. Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, ancient wisdom meets modern science in the best-tasting form possible. Grab yours today and start feeling the ultimate difference in health. With Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, inflammation doesn't stand a chance. Get yours today at thealexjonesstore.com.